Ladies and gents, we're already here. It's the 10th episode of Marking Out with Mike, hopefully slowly becoming your favorite wrestling podcast. I'm your host, as always, Mr. Michael Flanagan. I want to thank everybody for joining us here tonight. We're going to dive on into it. The Raw recap, 3 hours of show that we're going to try to squeeze into a 1 hour podcast for you here today. Hopefully it'll be enjoyable and hopefully we'll have some good insight for you guys. Surprisingly, not a lot of news and notes to cover. One of the first things I think that was interesting was we would tune into Raw last night. WWE had advertised, among other things, that Ali was going to issue a statement on his status as the leader of Retribution. He was supposed to, I guess, explain his motives and what was going on there. But if you watched Raw, or as you'll hear when we recap it, that segment did not happen. It was not referenced. It didn't happen. It didn't say it was canceled or postponed or anything. I imagine in time it will happen. It'll probably be next week, something like that. I think it's just a case of them trying to write the show, trying to deliver on all things. The draft is a ratings grab. It's a way to shake things up and to mix around the talent. I don't necessarily know that they need to do that. I think if they would just simplify some of the championships, especially championships like the tag team titles that don't truly have enough depth on their position in their division, I think you could switch guys up and it would just make a lot more sense. The men's tag division and the women's tag division are both great parts of the show, but they lack the depth. We have our great teams, New Day and Street Profits, obviously, which is why they are both respectively champions of their shows, but there's not very many true challengers below them, and I think it's about time WWE just embraces NXT as the true third brand. Let's stop referencing it as a developmental system. That's what it was for a long time, and it can still operate like that, but it doesn't need to be referred to. If they're going to put NXT as counter programming to AEW every Wednesday night and attempt to bring people over, it needs to be treated more like an A show. It can't be looked at as the third tier brand. If you're going to put talent, former Universal Champions like Finn Balor down there, and you're going to move these people around, just let it be a third brand. You could easily, in my opinion, eliminate the NXT tag team titles, just have the WWE tag team champions, and mix it in with all three shows. Because even if you have an up-and-coming tag team that is on NXT to get their feet wet, what better way to introduce them to fans than to put them in a position where they knock off the tag team champions? You look at who the champions are right now. It's Breezango. It's two guys that have main roster experience. I think Fandango made his WWE debut against Chris Jericho at WrestleMania. He beat Chris Jericho that year too, if I'm not mistaken. So, I mean, those guys aren't up-and-comers. They're already sort of doing it without being aware of it. So right there, if you just take the three tag team champions from each show, you've got three solid teams that you can build around. And then also just not breaking teams up, recognizing that you can do a Big E singles push without breaking up New Day. I'm not necessarily mad about that, but there are other ways they could go about it. WWE doesn't seem like they realize that they could do one without the other. So the other thing that we have today for the news and notes is WWE announced that on this week's edition of NXT, we will be determining the brand new number one contenders to Breezango's NXT Tag Team Championships. So there is going to be a showdown between the teams of Roderick Strong and Bobby Fish, both from Undisputed Era, taking on the team of Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. So possibly Lorcan and Burch will go over if they want to truly build up up-and-comers, things like that, or possibly Undisputed Era. I'd be fine with both scenarios. If you think about NXT, though, as a C-tier show or developmental,
you can't help but think to yourselves, well, if Undisputed Era goes over a group that has been emphatically built up and has proven their name value and are main roster players at this point, whether or not they're on NXT or Raw or SmackDown, you would look at a victory by them as holding the other guys down, or what a lot of casual internet wrestling fans love to say is a burial of Danny Burch and Oney Lorcan. But instead, if you would present NXT as the show that it is, sometimes NXT, consistently, I would even argue, is the best show of the three shows. When it comes from a pay-per-view perspective, I love takeovers. I would take almost any takeover over most of the pay-per-views we've seen in recent memory from Raw and SmackDown. So give the NXT guys a chance to be looked at as a third brand. You could still keep the NXT championship and the maybe even the North American championship, because there is probably enough mid-card depth if they do try to be unique and use those guys in proper ways. There's plenty of guys like Sami Zayn and Kevin Owens and Jeff Hardy, and the list is long, that you could use in the mid-card to keep all three of those championships around. But for the tag team titles, just make, I think, less is more with championships. Make the champions able to maybe travel to all shows. They'd have to play around with it. I would like to see something that actually seems like it's new creative thinking, like they're actually trying to think outside the box and not like they're just trying to phone it in every single day with all of this draft year after year after year. The format doesn't make sense. We saw 20 superstars on Raw, 20 superstars on SmackDown that were determined as draft eligible. Not every single person was drafted. They didn't really clarify how Raw got the first pick over SmackDown, why there were five picks instead of just making it even when it was two shows. On Raw, we saw an additional round, which we'll talk about, I'm imagining, because it's a longer show. But just nothing made sense. There's no rules. There's nothing you can look at as compared to a real draft by a real sport, where there's X amount of time on the clock and the teams can pick and the order is based on how you fared the previous season. Even Major League Baseball, in their draft coming up, they're switching it. It used to be that it went by your record. This year, mostly the same, but they're going to be doing it by where people fell in the standings on 2020. So, in theory, the worst show should get the best pick. But then you open a can of worms. WWE cannot present one of the shows as the worst show. So they need to tell us how. And in the past, we've seen them do that with matches. Whoever won this battle royal or did this or that was able to get the picks. And I think that that would probably be a good way to do it again. Without authority figures, it's hard to. And I would like to see something where it's not looked at as a rivalry, because there's no reason to believe that somebody employed by Raw would hate someone who's employed by SmackDown simply because they're on two separate brands. They're the same company. You're cashing your checks from the same Vince McMahon signature. It doesn't make sense from a logistics, from a realistic point of view, that somebody would hate each other for absolutely no reason, so they need to eliminate it. You know, I don't want to do fantasy booking, but that is part of the joy of this podcast, is we do get the opportunity to look into what ifs and dream scenarios and discuss dream matches and things like that. But in my fig fed, when I play with the little toys and I do what I want to do, or I mess around on the video game, in my mind, the vision that I have is you have the three shows, and then you have an overarching board of directors that kind of runs everything just like a company, and they all work together and everybody just makes things happen. And because everybody's on the same team, everybody wants the company to grow because everyone benefits from the growth of their employer. If the company makes more money, then you make more money. So it wouldn't make sense that you'd have a general manager of these two shows and they would go against each other. I think they can still have GMs, but I don't think that they should battle each other. These brand versus brand things at Survivor Series every year are not the best way to do it, in my opinion. Just build true rivalries like we saw in the past. Triple H versus The Undertaker, Stone Cold versus The Rock. Everybody hates each other. It's my team of four guys five, and your team of four, so 5-on-5, and we'll see who finally settles this all. There's other ways to sell that story. There's other ways to keep that traditional tag team match alive. But we can and we will debate this until we're blue in the face. So we won't go over that any further. In other news and notes, Finn Balor is recovering from surgery. He had surgery yesterday. So on Monday, he had his surgery. His jaw, of course, was fractured in two places. So as far as I understand, he's still the NXT champion. They haven't talked about taking the title off of him. I think the hope is just that he can heal up quickly. And I think they could keep it on him. I don't know what the ETA is. I've never had a broken jaw. I don't know how fast it can heal up. But we've seen guys, I mean, if Brock Lesnar can get the championship and legitimately be healthy as a horse and not necessarily defend it, then Finn Balor can hold the NXT championship hostage for a little bit. I think if they keep him on TV and they have him do stuff, maybe once he is healed up and at least can speak, even if he can't wrestle, they could have little vignettes and they could build it up in some way and you know, keep the belts on him, but not make it feel like the belt is being held hostage. So first and foremost, hopefully he has a speedy and quick recovery. We already know he's a tough son of a bitch, so he should be just fine. But look forward to seeing him back in the ring. Very excited that he's back on NXT, where he is used better as a talent. So hopefully he'll be back there and participating and entertaining all of us very, very soon. So again, we just keep it shorter. We've been trying to focus on less news and notes and more recap, especially on a night like Monday nights. Monday nights, we have to do some of the shortest segments because 3 hours is a hell of a lot of show to cover. I think normally when I type up my notes for the 2 hour shows for AEW and the rest of WWE and even Impact, those notes come out to be about like 6 pages. I think I have like 14 pages or something insane for Raw. And it's not necessarily because there's a lot of details to discuss. It's just such a long show. I don't know if the pacing is just different on Raw, but by the first hour, by the time it's 9 o'clock, I already feel like I've watched such a full show. And one thing that was interesting that we'll discuss is the first hour of Raw, we saw one match. It is a professional wrestling show, and almost the whole first hour, we only saw the one match that we're going to get into here momentarily, and everything else was just a soap opera. So, don't want to get too ahead of ourselves. We will now jump into the Raw recap and discuss everything that is going on in the world of professional wrestling. So, to open the show, a graphic is shown. It puts a spotlight on the new 20 superstars. We saw this before on SmackDown. 20 guys and gals that were apparently randomly generated. And these people were the ones that were going to be draft eligible. It included champions. It included men, women. Everyone was on there with the exception of announcers. Announcers seem to be safe, even though they've been up for draft in the past. So they highlight those ones. And noteworthy people that were shown, we saw the Intercontinental Champion, Sami Zayn. It's amazing that in your first night, if champions are eligible, that your first night of the draft, 5 rounds, you would not select all of your champions. You would think that if this is truly the network executives picking, your first picks would be, if there's any champions at all, even if it means double dipping. Could you imagine if a show got both the WWE and the Universal Champion, or if a show got both sets of the tag team champions? It just makes no sense that there would be a champion left after 5 rounds on night one. But Sami Zayn was left. Bayley, who was and is the longest reigning SmackDown Women's Champion of all time, their longest reigning champion, and they don't snatch her up. They don't have her on the show. She's still on the draft board. Could you imagine if Raw stole her away? And then all of Retribution was still available as well. That one, not so shocking, because if Retribution's goal is to destroy the WWE, obviously you don't want somebody like that on your roster. So it makes sense. They should go undrafted. So Randy Orton, for the second week in a row, starts the show. And we're all reminded that last week he pinned Drew McIntyre, center of the ring, in his first clean pinfall loss in nearly a year. They didn't tell us specifically. They couldn't tell us because I don't think that they track it. I don't think anybody had time to actually go back through the archives and see when the last time he lost a clean match was, because they don't keep track of that. We are told with the Braun Strowman and the Keith Lee thing that it doesn't count towards a guy's win-loss record. Nothing counts. All of it is storybook. It's written the way it is. Wins and losses don't mean anything. It's one thing that I mark out for on AEW, the idea that I can track the wins and losses. I mean, even in my Fig Fed, when I'm just playing fantasy matches, I keep track of that. I have a spreadsheet, as dorky as that is, where I track who wins, who loses, who's been champion, and how many times they've been champion, what day they got it. I track all the details. Now, that second half, WWE does as well. You know, you can look back and tell that R-Truth has been 24 champion 42 times, as crazy as that is. And I just wish they recorded the wins and losses, because if they did, I think they would pay more attention. Like, holy shit, we've had this superstar lose 26 matches in a row, or 42, or whatever it was. We're all told that the Kurt Hawkins storyline, where he was on that crazy losing streak that he eventually broke at WrestleMania, WWE became aware of that because a fan on Twitter mentioned it. And then they were like, oh shit, you know, we shouldn't do this to the poor guy. We should give him a win. And then Kurt Hawkins had the foresight that, hey, if I'm already this far in, I may as well keep losing and then somewhere down the line have it have a big payoff. And then if you remember, they did have the big payoff where he would eventually, alongside Zack Ryder, win the WWE Tag Team Championships in New York at WrestleMania. So it was a great moment there. But I like that the competition does keep track. But still, it paints a big good picture. Randy Orton is deadly. He's a 13-time former world champion. And he just beat the current champion leading into the pay-per-view. So after they remind us of that, they tell us that this will be the 8th time that the Viper has been locked inside a Hell in a Cell match, which is sort of impressive and sort of not. Part of it is just comes from knowing how much they overbooked that match, knowing that we're going to see a minimum of 2 Hell in a Cells per year, and this year we're going to see 3. 3 Hell in a Cell matches on one pay-per-view. It's pretty wild. So it doesn't have the same ring to it as it does when we know how many Hell in a Cell matches a guy like Triple H was in back when he was in his prime and he was actively wrestling. And the stipulation did not pop itself up every 12 months. So the picture's being painted that he does have the advantage. I thought he was going to become champion in the ambulance match at Clash of Champions, and he didn't. So I don't know if he's due. I don't know if they're wanting to put the championship on it for a 4th time. I don't know if Hell in a Cell is the pay-per-view to do so, or if they want to stretch it out further. Drew deserves everything he's getting right now. He deserves all the praise, all the respect, and he deserves a good long title run. So he'll probably continue. It's hard to pinpoint right now. Generally, when a person is made to look strong heading into the pay-per-view, they eventually do lose. They get their comeuppance. So if Orton is being the one to get booked with all these victories and such, then perhaps he won't win. But it's still too far off. We've still got a couple more weeks to go before we can make predictions. I do, alongside a lot of other WWE fans, during pay-per-views, I go on Twitter and I make predictions and I chat with fans. So if you're not following me on Twitter, Mike S. Flanagan is my handle. You can follow me there. You can tell me what you think of my predictions and kind of keep everything going. So They bring up the possibility that Randy Orton could be drafted because he was not yet drafted at this point, and that Drew McIntyre says he wanted to take the chance to beat the crap out of Orton as much as he possibly could, and they actually jumped right to it. It wasn't a false finish. He stormed the ring. I thought Orton was going to roll out the other side and do some villain thing, but he stayed there, and the two of them would go at it, and they would start to brawl, and they spilled out to the ringside area. Orton got smashed into the ring post, and then eventually he took a back body drop onto the announce desk. It did not break. And they kept brawling. Eventually, Randy Orton would choose to fight another day, and he would escape the melee and kind of go backstage. So the draft started the first round of night two, and we saw Raw start things off by picking The Fiend. Makes sense. Fiend is a great talent. It was surprising that he wasn't picked first. And then SmackDown would grab the longest reigning SmackDown Women's Champion, Bayley, which makes sense. After leaving her off the board on night one, Raw would go ahead and grab Randy Orton. So that would mean that no matter what happened at the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view, Randy Orton and the WWE Championship would remain part of Monday nights regardless. So you would think that could be a good counterpoint if you maybe miss out on drafting Drew McIntyre because he went number one overall. If you're SmackDown, it's good strategy for you to want to go for Orton, because if he wins, then he brings you the WWE title. You have that title. You have the Universal title. You're looking good. But it wasn't meant to be. SmackDown would not get him. SmackDown would get some tag team championships, though, because they decided, hey, we're going to draft the Street Profits. So now you have your Raw Tag Team Champions on SmackDown and your SmackDown Tag Team Champions on Raw. And that would prove to be kind of confusing, but they would address that later on in the night. Charlotte Flair would stay on Raw. We haven't really seen her. And that would round out the first part of the draft for night two. So the Intercontinental title was still in play. No one thought enough of Sami Zayn, I guess. He's still on the board. And the Cruiserweight Champion was still on the board, which I didn't expect him to get drafted. That's kind of an NXT exclusive. It makes sense. And that could be another way that they could make NXT seem like a more legitimate brand, going to my earlier rant where I was talking about putting it on the same level as both Raw and SmackDown. If they said it was the exclusive home, I mean, I know we have 205 Live and that's supposed to be the exclusive home, but just say it's NXT. Nobody watches 205 with any regularity anyways. If it's not one of the main shows, I'd love to see the streaming numbers from things like Main Event and 205 Live, because I bet you they aren't good. You might have some younger kids that watch that stuff, but I can't imagine that they are very good numbers. So some good things to kind of look at and to consider that we're still on the board heading out. So the no disqualification match, that'd be the first match of the night. We were 20 minutes into the show by that point. Not too bad. We've seen that in the past. They build up the big segments and then we get a match. So it'd be Aleister Black versus Kevin Owens. The two would start brawling. Obviously, there's been a long history. Aleister Black has basically made it a Christmas tradition to show up every week on Raw and kick the shit out of Kevin Owens. The guy probably has CTE because he's taken a lot of black masks. A lot of those kicks straight to the dome. But he's still kicking. He's had a hell of a bad week. He had just fought The Fiend the past Friday night on SmackDown. So it'd be interesting to see how exactly he was going to come out of that and recover from that. He wasn't showing any signs of damage visibly from that encounter. The announcers would remind us, though, that he had just went to war with The Fiend. But he wasn't selling it. He wasn't showing any ailments or anything throughout his match. So Owens would eventually bring a table out from underneath the ring, a wooden table, didn't immediately get set up. He tried for a powerbomb, but he had no luck with that. Later in the encounter, Aleister Black would toss Kevin Owens, who was standing on top of the barricade outside the ring, onto the announcer's desk, which shockingly did not break, because we had already seen Randy Orton take a back body drop onto the table earlier in the evening, and now Owens was unable to break it. And he's had pretty bad luck with this in the past few nights over the course of the weekend where the table doesn't break. If you remember me talking about it or if you saw on SmackDown, he had to take two attempts to put the Fiend through the table last Friday on SmackDown. It was supposed to look like a pop-up powerbomb, but it looked more like D'Lo Brown's Sky High. And the first time he just more or less spine-bustered him on it and it didn't break. And then they eventually would go for it again. And it would break on that night. But it didn't break on this night. I don't know if it was supposed to because they did not attempt to do it a second time. The announcers kept selling his fight from Friday night. Aleister Black would then throw three chairs into the ring. There was already a steel chair in there from earlier in the encounter. So there were a total of four chairs in the ring at this point. Kevin Owens would take the advantage. And he would get him his way towards a pinfall. That would go for a two count, so the match would continue. Kevin Owens would start to sell a lot of back pain at this point from some of the damage that he was taking. So he was having a lot of trouble standing up. He couldn't stretch his back out straight. If you've ever been in a position like that, you know how painful it is. So that was interesting because they started to kind of bring it up and he started to look like he was in a bad way. And so then Kevin Owens would set up all four chairs in unison, kind of stacked frontwards towards each other to make like a little platform. He would take Aleister Black up onto the top rope, and it looked like he intended to superplex him from the top of the ropes all the way down through all four chairs. Could have been detrimental, could have eliminated him and allowed him to secure the victory in the match. But it wasn't meant to be. Aleister Black would battle out of it. He would push Owens. Owens would fall onto the chairs, not in like a rough way, but then he would hit the double knees, Aleister Black would, onto Kevin Owens, driving him through all four chairs, basically killing the guy. So he's in pretty bad shape. He's already been having a ton of back pain, and going through all four tables is definitely not going to be a good look. The Meteora, that's the name of that double knee that he does. But Kevin Owens, the tough son of a gun that he is, he did manage to kick out of that. Black would go outside. He would grab that table that had come into play earlier. He would bring that into the ring. He would set that up. Kevin Owens and him were back on the outside. They were brawling. Aleister would try to hit a Black mass, but he would miss, and his foot would hit the bottom turnbuckle. Again, you have to remember they were standing on the outside. At first, I thought his leg had hit the ring post, but it hit the turnbuckle. Owens ducked it. He threw him back into the ring, and he hit him with a stunner. And then he powerbombed him through the table, pinned him. 1, 2, 3. Kevin Owens got the victory. But the silver lining for Aleister Black, that's the most TV time he's gotten in terms of longevity. He's had a lot of sightings recently, but that was the longest like segment of television time that he had claimed in a while. And I don't know because I didn't pay attention, but I think this might be the first week we didn't see him with his eye all bandaged up too. So all his little eye pain and stuff that he was going through seems to have all healed up. So should be a good sign for Mr. Rey Mysterio, who got his eye popped as well. Maybe it'll heal up. I don't know how that works from a scientific standpoint, but he was working. So the following segment was setting up Mandy Rose and Dana Brooke. They were going to be on Miz TV. So this kind of answered my questions from the last podcast, where I was wondering whether or not The Miz would continue his feud with Otis through Mandy over on Monday Night Raw. Originally, I thought maybe not, but we remember that he was the reason that she got sent over there, and they would explain it away pretty good. Sometimes the good old WWE can be a little bit lazy and not do the greatest job at explaining things, but I really bought into how they explained this on Miz TV. So before we would get to Miz TV, though, we would have the second round of the draft for the night, and the picks would be as follows. Raw would get Braun Strowman. SmackDown would opt to keep Daniel Bryan, who Stephanie McMahon did call a B-plus player. Raw would go with Matt Riddle. SmackDown got Kevin Owens right off of his victory, so perhaps he impressed them. And then Jeff Hardy would come to Raw which that one felt like a change. All the other picks were just like, But Jeff Hardy coming to Raw for some reason, probably no one else feels this way, but I was like, oh, you know, that's kind of actually a change of pace. So we'll see what happens there. But that was now two rounds into night two, and we had still not seen anyone grab up the Intercontinental Champion. It's just amazing. That championship, second to only the WWE title, has the absolute most history in the company. We all know its history. Pat Patterson, first ever champion. Jericho with the most championship reigns total. It's a stepping stone. You get that championship. You're proving yourself. You're one of the top dogs in the company. Potential future world champion if you haven't already been. And still, no one claimed it. And even if you just look at Sami Zayn from a superstar's perspective, the tenacity that his character was showing, he was the Intercontinental Champion before COVID, and then you look at how things went down, he left, he was more or less stripped of the title, a new champion was crowned, he came back, he said, you know what, that doesn't sit right with me, I was the champion, you guys said that if I left for COVID, there would be no ramifications, and you took the title off of me, so I'm going to take the title back. That shows resilience, that the guy comes back and reclaims what's his and more or less sticks it to the man. And still, none of these executives at USA or Fox thought enough to keep the guy. So maybe, I don't know. I've never ran a television network, so I guess they know some things that I don't know. So Miz TV would now take center stage. It was set up earlier. And Miz and Morrison would start mocking Otis and Tucker and how they had broken up. Miz said that he didn't say it, but he talked about how he has close personal relationships with USA Network. And then it clicked with me. I was like, you know what? That makes sense, actually. Even though it's not real, you think about Miz has his little summer show that he has on USA where the people go on the water slide and he does commentary or whatever. It's like an American Ninja Warrior type of thing. And then he has his show with Maurice, his reality show, Miz and Mrs. So for kayfabe reasonings, you're like, oh, Miz has got it in with USA Network and he has some pull with them. And that's what they went with. That actually made sense. I could see in my mind how a scenario like that could be realistic, even though it's a little far-fetched. I like that they tied up the loose end and that they actually said it in a way that makes sense. Miz would go on to say he is the face of the USA Network and basically imply that he had asked them to take Tucker to Raw so that way Tucker and Otis would be broken up. Otis was now all alone on SmackDown because, of course, he took away his girlfriend, Randy Orton. Yeah, Otis's girlfriend, Randy Orton. His girlfriend, Mandy Rose, rather. So I like that. That was acceptable. Mandy Rose was in the ring at this point with her tag team partner, Dana Brooke. She would talk about how Miz is ruining people's lives. And she would touch on those same subjects about how she got traded because Miz didn't want her to be around Otis and didn't want Otis to be happy. Miz would then try to drive a wedge between the new tag team of Dana Brooke and Mandy Rose. He would bring up the dual-branded Battle Royal, which would see the winner getting a shot at Asuka's Raw Women's Championship. He talked about how they would have to go up against each other and how only one of them could win that opportunity. And they more or less just said, you know, may the best woman win. And before the wedges could be driven any further, Lana and Natalya would come out. The two ladies' teams would throw a bunch of shade back and forth at each other. No, you suck. I don't suck. You suck. And a little catfight would break up. So we do go to commercial break, and when we return, the women are gone, and it's just Miz and Morrison. And apparently, Miz TV is still going on. So Miz would reveal that he has a second guest. I forget what he called him, but the guest turned out to be John Morrison. And he would just hype up the Miz, talk about how great the Miz is. And before it could get too layered on thick, the familiar music of Mr. Lars Sullivan would hit. And he would come down. So if you remember, he had beat up Miz the previous show on SmackDown, but John Morrison had gotten away unscathed. So it was more or less the same thing you've ever seen. Every Lars beatdown is about the same, minus the headbutt. There was no flying headbutt. I know he's done that in the past. We haven't seen that since his return. But he would come down. So pretty much the main thing that would happen is Miz got away this time, and John Morrison would take the ass whipping. So nothing really big there. I don't know. John Lars can beat up tag teams, so maybe he's going to get a tag team title match. Obviously, that's not what I actually think is happening. They're just trying to build him up as a monster. We saw it beforehand, before he left. He beat up Kurt Angle and all these people, and it led nowhere. So now he's beating people way beneath the Hall of Fame status, and that's supposed to lead somewhere. The guy's probably not long for WWE. He keeps getting in a lot of trouble, and we're told that he doesn't have any supporters backstage, but he only has one. But it is the one that matters. It's Mr. Vincent Kennedy McMahon. So if you only got to have one friend in WWE, obviously that's the friend you want to have. So he's going to keep on doing that thing, and we'll see how long it lasts. So we cut backstage. Adam Pearce is talking to the Raw and SmackDown Tag Team Champions, who have been flip-flopped and traded to each other's shows. And what they did here was dumb, but at least they did give us some explanation. A lot of fans are a lot more upset about this than I am in terms of internet reaction. I am pretty much okay with WWE doing whatever they want as long as it sort of makes sense. It doesn't have to be very logical. It just has to half-ass make sense, and I'll give them a pass. So Adam Pearce said, hey, you give them your titles and they'll give you your titles. So the champions were like, no, we don't want to do that. These are our titles. And then Adam Pearce was like, no, but that's how it's going to be. And then with no further hesitation, they were like, okay. And then they traded titles and happily ever after. So now New Day are the Raw Tag Team Champions and the Street Profits are the SmackDown Tag Team Champions. So I guess it makes sense. I'd be curious to see how it reflects. I haven't checked WWE's website and the Hall of Champions to see, because if so, does that make Street Profits the Triple Crown Champions? They had a legitimate run with the NXT tag titles. They had this legitimate run with the Raw tag team titles. And now that they've been gifted the SmackDown titles, does that count as a new reign? Are they on day one of their reign at this point? Or does it continue off of what they were already doing with the Raw Tag Team Championships? I don't know if they're going to put any effort into actually explaining that away. But Bobby Roode and Ziggler would come up and remind us that they were part of that team last week with Randy Orton when Drew McIntyre lost. So that also resulted in a loss of the Street Profits. So they said, hey, we're owed a Raw Tag Team title match because we were part of that winning effort to beat the champions. So New Day was like, well, technically, we're the Raw Tag Team Champions, so we'll take that fight. I like that fighting spirit. I thought that was pretty cool. So that was how they handled that situation with the champions being drafted. And then round three would happen. So we're going to see another five picks and see exactly who is being drafted where. Raw would go first, and Raw decided, hey, why don't we draft all five members of Retribution? They're trying to put us out of business. We already gave them a contract, which doesn't make sense. Let's bring them onto our show so they can destroy us from within. We're in a competition, supposedly, against SmackDown. Instead of letting SmackDown get them, we're going to grab them up because that makes sense. So SmackDown would say, oh, we also have a stupid pick to make. We're going to take Lars Sullivan. At least that one sort of made sense because he actually kayfabe works for the company. Raw would then get back on track with a more legitimate pick. They would pick Keith Lee. SmackDown would keep King Corbin, so that way he can do another 2 years of the same King of the Ring gimmick that every single King of the Ring winner of all time has ever done. King Corbin was like, why don't I just keep on stretching this bullshit out? Raw would then pick Alexa Bliss. So I was really excited about this because The Fiend had been drafted to Raw earlier in the night, And that's currently one of my favorite things going in WWE. So I was like, you know what? This is good. I'm glad they're keeping them together. I already liked Alexa Bliss more or less because she's from the state of Ohio. And I like Ohio. As silly as that is, that's a good enough reasoning for me. So I'm excited to see her in a good program and continuing on a good path and kind of see where that thing could go. And we would see some fun stuff from the two of them later in the night that you can look forward to. So there's still two more rounds to go, or so we thought. I would later find out that there was a sixth round, but still no Sami Zayn. Sami Zayn's still on the board. His resiliency, his title, apparently, they didn't mean to do this. They kind of told us that the Intercontinental title is the most worthless title in the company because they drafted the two heavyweight championships, the United States Championship, both tag teams, and even the women's tag team champions, all before they drafted the Intercontinental Champion. Despite all the lineage and everything, they said, let's go this route. So it is what it is. We have to accept it, and the show rolls on. Next up, Seth Rollins would come out and do his farewell to Raw. He would come out, put himself over, talk about how everyone on Raw is losing because they are losing him. He asks who is going to be the leader that he was and fill his shoes. So Jeff Hardy comes out, and Rollins says that Hardy isn't a leader and asks him to get out of his ring. Jeff Hardy reminds him that technically he's a part of Raw now and Seth is a part of SmackDown, so he says that it's actually his ring. I like that. That made sense. Seth revealed that Jeff Hardy would take on Lars Sullivan on SmackDown on Friday. So I don't know why Seth Rollins was the one to break that news. I don't know why Seth Rollins had that news. Why they'd be like, hey, you have no idea you're going to run into Jeff Hardy later tonight, but let's just tell you that Lars is on there. So it makes no sense why, if the draft is over after tonight, would a newly acquired SmackDown superstar be taking on a former SmackDown star who is now a member of Raw. So right out of the gate, the draft means nothing. We knew it wouldn't, and it's going to continue not meaning anything. But that's a match for absolutely no one to look forward to because it's going to have no long-term ramifications. It's not going to build Lars Sullivan, even if he goes over on the former three-time WWE champion. But it's the route that they want to go. So Seth Rollins would start to leave. AJ Styles' music would hit, and the two would cross paths as one was entering and one was exiting. And AJ Styles would say, yeah, you better keep on stepping because it was never Monday Night Rollins to begin with. So Seth would then turn around, and he didn't like that. So Jeff Hardy takes the mic, and he has booking power, and he says, I want to face the two of you in a triple threat tag team match tonight. And you can go back and watch the clip. He literally said, I want to face the two of you in a tag team match. Obviously, he didn't mean to say tag team because of his history and being a longtime tag wrestler. It probably just slipped out. We would go to a break and we would come back and it would just be a traditional three-way match. The announcers didn't attempt to explain it away. I think everybody just knew, oops, my bad, I misspoke. So they would fight. We were an hour and 15 minutes into the show at this point now. We're in the second hour. About 10:15 or no, 9:15. And this was only our second match of the night. So for a brief moment, Seth Rollins and AJ Styles would briefly double team on Jeff Hardy. Eventually, that would be short-lived, and AJ would attack Rollins. And Seth would go to try to issue a stomp. AJ Styles was kind of on his back in a prone position. But Jeff Hardy did a poetry in motion off of AJ's back and prevented Seth from hitting the stomp. Rollins would later take a swanton bomb, but he did kick out of that, and then Jeff would hit a twist of fate onto AJ Styles, and then completely out of nowhere, literally out of nowhere, Elias came out of the frame, and he had his guitar, and he just murdered Jeff Hardy. He just broke the shit out of that guitar over Jeff Hardy's back. When I saw the replay, it didn't look quite as crazy as I thought it did when it first happened. I thought he just dome shot at him. But on the replay, I did see that it was a back shot. But it was really cool. It caught me by surprise. Elias has been out on injury the The last time we saw him, it was explained that he was hit by a car. We would think that the car was driven by a drunk Jeff Hardy. We would later find out that it was Sheamus trying to set him up. So this is our first time seeing Elias. The injuries that they said he had, even though that's not the way he sustained them, those were legitimate injuries, I believe. He had a torn pec and something else. So that's why he was written off TV in that way. So it was a good surprise because he's one of those names you like and you know, but you sometimes, if he's not on TV, you forget about him. So that was a good return there. So Raw would now start the fourth round, and they would say, hey, let's draft Elias. So perhaps the medical doctors had told the powers that be at the networks or at WWE that Elias would be back, because it seems weird that they would know he was available and they would burn a pick on a superstar that they thought was injured. But by golly, they took that gamble and it paid off, because just one segment beforehand, he had returned like Jesus. Just an absolute miracle. So SmackDown finally said, you know what? It might be nice to keep the Intercontinental Championship and not let Raw snag it. Raw obviously doesn't want it, because we're now four rounds in of night number two. Five rounds on the first night. Here we are, four rounds in deep. Fuck it. Let's take the guy. So kind of shitty, because it makes the Intercontinental title look like crap. But I don't think most people thought about it like that, because I don't think most people put thought into it. Raw would get Lacey Evans, which was exciting, because I had just that same day, Monday afternoon, gone on Amazon and ordered a Lacey Evans action figure. So congrats, Lacey Evans. You're going to get a few pennies off of the action figure that I bought, and you're going to continue to get your paycheck signed as a member of Monday Night Raw. SmackDown decided to keep Shinsuke Nakamura and Cesaro together, so that's good. That means that they'll continue to be a tag team, which is exciting. I like them. Both of those guys are eligible to, you know, work well on their own, but they work well as a tag team as well. So they're going to stay a tag team. The division needs all the help it can get, so that makes sense. And Raw would wind things out by going with Mr. Celtic Warrior Sheamus. We had one round left, or so we thought. And for some reason, earlier in the night when we saw Dana Brooke and her teammate teaming up in a cat fight against Lana and Natalia, they said, hey, let's have a tag team match. Later tonight, we're all going to be in a battle royal. Winner becomes number one contender for the Raw Women's Championship, the most prestigious title if you're a women's superstar. Why don't we tire each other out and fight each other? Not let's wait and see what happens next week. Let's take this out tonight. I guess they were that upset. So that would be our next match, a women's tag team match. It'd be the third match of the night. Seems like bad strategy, but it is what it is. So to start the match, the heels would isolate Dana in the corner. Mandy Rose would later come in off of a hot tag, and she would do the typical hot tag stuff, and she would clean the house. Rose and Brooke would eventually pick up the win over the equivalent of a female job squad. And after the match, Natty was like, nope, I've been losing too long. I'm not going to do this again. She called Lana stupid, and she broke up with her. She broke up the tag team, and that was all that she wrote for that tag team. So I guess they're not friends anymore, and the boat is on her own. So we would then see the Hurt Business chatting backstage, all looking sharp, wearing suits, and Ricochet would come up to them, and he said he had a proposition. He said that the draft is probably going to break up friends, and after tonight, he might be on his own. So his proposition was they pick one of them to take him on. If he wins, then they leave him alone and their business is done. If he loses, he would join the Hurt Business. So interesting ramifications regardless, and that would be accepted. Cedric Alexander said, hey, I'll beat you up and make you join the Hurt Business. That'll be a pleasure. So after that, we would see Angel Garza, who was drafted by Raw on Saturday night.
and he would be in a match against his former tag team partner, Andrade. Zelina Vega, who was done with those guys, was like, why don't I prove how done I am with them by sitting in on commentary? So she kind of talked about how those guys wasted opportunities. She said Garza could have been a former United States champion, just like Andrade was, if he would have just stuck with Vega, but he squandered that opportunity. So Garza's leg was wrapped, and Andrade would attack his leg. He would go after that all night, and Andrade would eventually go on and get the win, and Zelina Vega would join him in the ring. So I don't know if those two are going to have a reunion, or if she was coming in to just gloat because she's obviously upset with Angel Garza. But before that segment could go anywhere, the lights would go out. And originally, I thought it was Retribution because we were told that we would see and hear a statement from Ali. But it would turn out to be The Fiend, newly acquired. But instead of seeing him, we saw Alexa Bliss hanging upside down in the corner, doing that thing that Bray Wyatt usually does. And then, as the two backed away from her because they were creeped out, The Fiend would be behind them. So The Fiend would grab Andrade. Alexa Bliss would grab Zelina Vega. They would set him up for Sister Abigail's in stereo. They did the forehead kiss at the same time, and then they leveled their opponents. So that looked really cool. I like that. I want to see where these guys continue to go with this. I like the creepiness. I like that it doesn't seem like it's going to be a romantic angle and that she's just kind of brainwashed and in his cult and all that kind of stuff. So the fifth round, which I thought at the time was the final round, would see five more picks. Raw would select Nikki Cross so she can still interact with Alexa Bliss. SmackDown would take Ziggler and Rude, which would keep those two together. And then Raw was like, hey, we got to keep the 24/7 champion. He's had the title 42 times. We got to keep him on our show. So they went with R-Truth. And that was a title. We were talking about how the Intercontinental title was in the mix for so long. That was a title that was up for play for a long time. But it is 24/7, so maybe it's a smart pick that SmackDown didn't get it, because they could always maybe send one of their superstars to a pay-per-view where the superstars will still interact and possibly get R-Truth pinned that way and maybe take the title. SmackDown's last pick would turn out to be Apollo Crews, and then Raw would go with that Kato guy from Raw Underground. He's just the big meathead that looks exactly like the Authors of Pain that they fired. So we'll see how he does, because now he's probably going to be on the main show a little bit more outside of those segments. So we will see if he has any success on the main roster. Rude and Ziggler were up against the New Day for the Raw Tag Team titles. And during the entrances, New Day would kind of mock Ziggler and Rude and do their same entrance poses behind them as they entered the ring. It was mentioned that with New Day now being the Raw Tag Team champions, they were tied for the most WWE Tag Team title reigns of any team tied up with the Dudley Boys. So this is, of course, counting only WWE title reigns that the Dudleys had, not counting their reigns in Japan, TNA, Impact Wrestling, and other places like that. Don't know if that's counting the ECW championship tag team title that they had 8 times, or if it's counting the WCW titles as well, because technically WWE does own those championships. But I can't imagine it is, because I think they were saying that last week the New Day were 7-time tag team champions in terms of SmackDown. So this would mark their 8th. And we all know that the Dudley Boys had the ECW title 8 times. And this would obviously not count any of their WWE title reigns. So they did try to put them in good company there. So some highlights of the match was, at one point, Rude would help throw Dolph Ziggler in the air, and he would hit a super high Famouser as he would come down. He hit it onto Xavier Woods, I believe. New Day would go on. They'd hit the Midnight Hour, and that would allow them to retain the championship. It was a really good match. I didn't take too many notes on it, but it's a good match. Good TV title
little segment match. I enjoyed it. So Elias was walking around backstage. He was stopped for an interview. He put over a new CD that he apparently has coming out on October 26th. He did mention the car angle specifically and that he thought Jeff Hardy was the one who did it. So apparently he didn't get to watch SmackDown that night because he was in the hospital. And he's not aware that it was Sheamus. He says that, you know, cops were looking for a red-haired assailant, but he didn't put two and two together. So maybe with Sheamus being on Raw now, he and Hardy and, you know, the three of them can kind of keep that angle going and see where they want to go with that. So Cedric Alexander would take on Ricochet next. We know the implications there. If Ricochet loses, he's in the Hurt Business. If he wins, he's free. Free from them. So Cedric would have a lot of intensity. It was his new, like, Hurt Business attitude. He would bring the pain. He would do really well. Eventually, the referee would take a small bump and would be distracted, kind of out of action there for a second. And MVP would slide a chair in the ring, but Ricochet intercepted it. He noticed that the referee was coming at two, so he took a page out of Eddie Guerrero's book, and he threw the chair to Cedric. Well, first he slammed it on the ground so the ref would hear it. He then threw it to Cedric, and then he took a really, like, funny-looking fall and basically sold it as if he had been knocked out by the chair. So that was cool. That was a creative way to win. And he was like, you know, I don't care that I won like a dirty fox. At least I'm through with the Hurt Business. So he's free of them, and I guess they're going to leave him alone. So WWE then told us that there would be more picks taking place after the show ended on Raw Talk, which is just one of their little after show segments. So we would get more picks there. And then there's the sixth round, which I didn't know we were going to get. So just looking at that real fast, we saw Raw getting Titus O'Neil, SmackDown getting Carmella, Raw went with Peyton Royce, SmackDown got Aleister Black, and then Raw got Akira Tozawa. Interesting use of their final pick, but they were like, we got to get Tozawa because he's a ratings grabber. So our main event would be the Women's Battle Royal. Asuka was on commentary, which is always funny. Before the action, Nia took the mic, said if any of the women want to eliminate themselves and save themselves from a beating, that they can do so. No women, of course, did opt to take her up on that. So they would fight. She would square up with Tamina. It was supposed to be, ooh, look at these two powerful houses. Tamina would actually get eliminated. She was the first eliminated of the night. Billie Kay was going to be eliminated shortly thereafter by Nia Jax. Nia would then go save her tag team partner, who was being double teamed by Mandy Rose and Dana Brooke. And she then eliminated both of those two women. Baszler would then eliminate Nia Jax, basically not caring. Nia got super pissed. She pulled Lana out of the ring because Lana was standing right there. She slammed her through the table for the fourth time in a row. And then we cut to the back. Not for commercial, but we cut to the back because Randy Orton and Drew McIntyre are beating the smack out of each other. They're fighting, throwing each other into the garage, things like that. Then we go to a commercial. We come back from the commercial. The girls are still fighting. Number one contender. Everything's on the line. And Nikki Cross would take a women's right. She was standing on the apron after going over the top rope. Women's right to cross would knock her out, eliminate her from the match. Peyton Royce was eliminated by Natalya during the break. They showed us that. And then the EST of WWE would eliminate Shayna Baszler, which was one of the biggest threats in the match. She would end up getting double teamed by the Riot Squad, Ruby Riott and Liv Morgan. So the final four was Ruby Riott, Liv Morgan, Natalya, and Lacey Evans. So both members of the Riott Squad would go on and get eliminated, and then we were down to the final two. At this point, Asuka was shown backstage. After the table broke, she didn't want to hang out there anymore, so she was watching it on her little television screen and enjoying the action. And then we would see Natalya make the elimination. She was the last one standing until we found out that Lana had never been officially eliminated. Lana got back in there, said, "You don't break up with me." Beat the hell out of her, threw her out. So now Lana wins the match. She's the number one contender to everybody's surprise. And apparently she's going to take on Asuka at some point for the Raw Women's Championship. So it'll be interesting to see where those two go. Kind of fast forwarding because we're almost out of time here. We would see the two men that were battling Orton and Drew, fighting some more. Officials would come and break them up. The show would end. And then on the after show, we would see Raw picking Eric of the Viking Raiders. SmackDown would get Billy Kay, Zelina Vega, and Tamina Snuka. And then Dorado and Metalik would go to Raw, basically breaking up Lucha House Party, because we know that the other guy, Kalisto, was on SmackDown. So Andrade and Mickey James were never selected by any official brand, so I guess they're free agents. We'll see if they end up getting signed anywhere, if Zelina Vega and him reunite, if something plays out with Mickey James. But guys, that's 60 minutes. That's another show. That's a three-hour recap. We crammed it all in with a few news and notes. Thank you for listening. We'll be back again soon with NXT and AEW recaps. Until then, I'm tapping out.